welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. Thanks for tuning in and spending your valuable time with me and my wonderful guests. And if you like that musical opening, it was part of a cut by Diva Haley, and her DVD, or CD, I'm sorry, is called Sacred Alchemy, and that particular cut was called Kali. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and I'm the author of the two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Whether you're an armchair tourist or you can actually get out there with boots on the ground, whether you're a solitary practitioner or part of a group looking for fresh ideas to incorporate goddess-inspired living into your life, well, I invite you to check out both my books at my website at KarenTate.com. Learn more about my books, tours, workshops, classes, and our Sacred Sunday services held every fourth Sunday in North Hollywood if you're in the area. And while you're there at my website, please take advantage of the free downloadable meditations. They are my gift to you, my listeners. And remember, please, Blog Talk is not free to hosts like myself, and contributions are welcome. I actually pay out of my pocket to give my guests a platform to teach and share their wisdom, and I've been doing that for the past 3 years. There are PayPal buttons on my Goddess Store page if you'd like to make a credit card contribution of any size, or you can always send a check. If you want to communicate with me about how to do that, you can email me at karentate108@ca.rr.com. Well, tonight it is my great pleasure to have on the show Danica Anderson chatting about her book, Blood and Honey, The Secret History of Women, discussing how women survive the trauma of war crimes and heal their communities. And that important conversation will be followed by my interview with Leigh McCloskey. He is an author, artist, and actor. We'll discuss his Sophia Temple in Malibu, California. And our topic for tonight is the mythic and heroic feminine as revealed in art, tarot, and visual philosophy. But first, do you remember that sound? If you're a longtime listener, you sure might. I'm back to my What's the Buzz segments. Well, you know, I just can't avoid it with everything happening in the news. That's when I share with you the bees that are buzzing round in my bonnet. This week, I want to share some excerpts from a real ass-kicking article that's been making the rounds of the internet. It's by Soraya Chamali. I believe it was on the Huffington Post. And it's entitled, 10 Reasons the Rest of the World Thinks the U.S. is Nuts. And it's about the misogyny of the Republican Party. Just in case you've been too busy and haven't been paying attention, you have to know what they're up to across the country to demean, demoralize, and deprive women of their dignity, equality, and human rights. So let me start with Chamali's article. She says, this week, the Georgia State Legislature debated a bill in the House that would make it necessary for some women to carry stillborn or dying fetuses until they naturally go into labor. In arguing for this bill, Representative Terry England described his empathy for pregnant cows and pigs in the same situation. She says, I have a question for Terry England. Sam Brownback, Rick Santorum, Rick Perry, and too many others. I have three daughters. Two of them are twins. If one of my twins had been stillborn, would you have made me carry her to term, thereby endangering both the other twin and me? Or would you have insisted that the state order a mandatory fetal extraction of the living twin fetus from my womb so that I could continue to carry the stillborn one to term and possibly die myself? My family is curious, and since you believe my uterus is your public property, I am too. Mr. England, unlike the calves and pigs for which you express so much empathy, I am not a beast of burden. I am a woman, and I have these human rights: the right to life, the right to privacy, the right to freedom, the right to bodily integrity, the right to decide when and how I reproduce. My human rights outweigh any you or the state corruptly and cynically seek to assign to a mass of dividing cells that will eventually turn into a natural person. Personhood for zygote-based bills and related legislation like Georgia's and hundreds of others, bills and laws that criminalize pregnancy and abortion and penalize women for being women, violate my human rights. Just because you can't get pregnant doesn't mean I cannot think clearly, ethically, morally, rationally about my body, human life, or the consequences of my actions. Just because you cannot get pregnant does not mean that I do not have rights when I am pregnant. I have responsibility but am powerless. You have power but are irresponsible with my rights. By not trusting me, you force me to not trust you, and you are not trustworthy. I gestate humans. You do not. I know how it feels to be pregnant. You do not. I know what happens to a fetus in a womb. You do not. I have carried 3 fetuses to term. You have not. What I experience when I am pregnant is not empathy. It's permeability. The fetus is me, and the state is you, apparently. But no matter what you say or do, I have fundamental human rights. What makes you think that you, who cannot have this fully human experience, can tell me anything about gestation or how I experience it, especially when you compare my existence and experience to that of brutish animals? The rest of the civilized world thinks this country has lost its mind. It's no wonder. Look at this list of frenzied misogyny. And she goes on to list about 10 different examples about laws that have been passed in states that are controlled by Republican Congresses. Number one, making women carry stillborn fetuses to full term because cows and pigs do. Number two, consigning women to death to save a fetus. Number three, criminalizing pregnancy and miscarriages and arresting, imprisoning, and charging women who miscarry with murder. Number four, forcing women to undergo involuntary vaginal penetration, otherwise called rape, with a condom-covered 6 to 8 inch ultrasound probe. Number five, disabling women or sacrificing their lives by either withholding medical treatment or forcing women to undergo involuntary medical procedures. Six, giving zygotes personhood rights while systematically stripping women of their fundamental rights. Seven, inhibiting, humiliating, and punishing women for their choices to have an abortion for any reason by levying taxes specifically on abortion, including abortion sought by rape victims to end their involuntary insemination, imposing restrictive requirements like 24-hour wait periods, and empowering doctors to lie to female patients about their fetuses in order to avoid prosecution. In Arizona, Kansas, Texas, Virginia, Colorado, Arkansas, and other states around the country, bills that make women pay for their choices are abounding. Eight, allowing employers to delve into women's private lives and only pay for insurance when they, the employers, agree for religious or moral reasons with how she chooses to use birth control. Number nine, sacrificing women's overall health and the well-being of their families in order to stop them from exercising their fundamental human right to control their own body and reproduction. 10, depriving women of their ability to earn a living and support themselves and their families. I've only read the heading of each paragraph. She goes into detail and gives examples of where these things are actually happening and the links to articles about these bills. I really recommend any of you listeners, if you have not read this article yet, if you haven't seen it on my Facebook page, if I haven't emailed it to you, if someone else hasn't emailed it to you, go to the Huffington Post. Look for Soraya Chamali's article, 10 Reasons the Rest of the World Thinks the U.S. is Nuts. And she concludes, I'm just going to give a few last conclusions here. She says, this is not about sex and property. I'm sorry, let me rephrase. She says, this is about sex and property, not life and morality. This is not about freedom of religion. This is about keeping women's wombs public and in other people's control, the exact opposite of private and in their own control. She says, I am not crazy. I am angry. Well, A lot of us feel that way. A lot of us are very angry. I can see why our foremothers, the fem-Nazis, like Rush called them, were very angry. Because if this is what they were putting up with decades ago, and I'm sure it was probably even worse then, you know, no wonder they were angry, and rightly so. And you know what? I think we're just so angry that we're going to show these Republicans just how angry we are in November and sweep these misogynists from office. You and your religious ideology who wants to control women and deprive us of our rights as human beings and as women. This is just insane. So those are the bees that were buzzing around in my bonnet tonight. That's my two cents. That's why I'm telling my friends who want to stay home and not vote for Obama because he hasn't done enough, or those who want to lodge a protest vote for a doomed third-party candidate, or heaven forbid, those folks out there who vote Republican because their daddy used to. Well, these extremists are not the Republican Party of your daddy's day. We need to wipe them from office for the sake of women everywhere and to ensure the Paul Ryan budget and theocracy does not change the United States as we know it. So, listeners, thank you for listening, and as always, I welcome your comments. And remember, you can always catch any show from the archives, and you can listen via iTunes as well. So stay tuned in and call in if you like. Now, as I was starting the show, Denisa has not called in yet. We spoke this morning. I am not sure where she is. She is delayed. So I am going to make a quick phone call to her and see where she is. And while I'm doing that, I am going to let you listen to some music. Let me just, why don't I finish that Kali song that we started by Diva Haley, let you hear it all the way through, and that'll give me a minute to try to reach Denisa on the phone. Here we go. Denisa on the line here. Let me check. Hey, Denisa, is that you?
That's me.
Okay, I'm so glad we were able to connect and get you on the show here. I was beginning to get a little worried.
Well, you know, the way I travel, I confuse mountain time with Pacific time, I'll tell you that.
Well, that's okay. I'm just glad I reached you and was able to get you on before it was time for my second guest to come on the air.
Okay.
So I want to thank you for your, for being with us tonight. And before we start our chat about, women surviving the trauma of war and how they heal themselves in their communities, let me just tell my listeners a little bit about you.
Okay.
Is it Denisa or Danica?
It's Danica, yeah.
Danica, okay. Danica, she is a certified clinical criminal justice specialist. She's the CEO of the COLO, Women's Cross-Cultural Collaboration, and we'll ask her to tell us a bit about that. She's an international consultant, a presenter, and author of many published articles. The book that we're going to be talking primarily about tonight is Blood and Honey, the Secret History of Women, South Slavic Women Experiences in a War of Modern-Day Terrorist Warfare, How Daughters, Mothers, and Grandmothers Heal Their Communities and Circumvent Another Century of War. She also has another book out, Biosemiotics, Blood and Honey Icons, and I'm sure she'll tell us some more about herself as we get into the story of how you came to be involved with this sort of work, Danica.
Well, I think it started in childhood, and it probably started with my parents' journey from the former Yugoslavia after World War II. My mother was actually a concentration camp survivor. My father was one of the army, I guess, or what they called the
The Techniques.
No, Tito was with the partisans. So they were all outcast because they were with the King Peter and kind of exiled after the war, and they came to the States. And I saw how my parents, you know, that they were suffering, so to speak. And, of course, I didn't know it at the time because I was quite young. And even in the 60s and 70s, we barely understood what post-traumatic stress was. But now, looking back on it, my parents were into a lot of that PTSD, or what I call intergenerational trauma. It was just very present. And I think that's how it really started for me. I wanted to know how could violence be so perpetuated from one generation to another. I didn't have the vocabulary when I was growing up, but the older I got, the more I researched, I realized that we are shaped by our environment, but it also shapes our genetics, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I started, and I ended up getting my degrees and working in trauma, violence. I'm pretty much a trauma expert. And I never realized that I would be going back to Bosnia, former Yugoslavia, after the Balkan War. It wouldn't even be in my thought process. And I basically started there, and I started working with these Muslim female war crime survivors and war survivors. And I realized, I remember one time when I was working with them, that there was 100 years of war.
So that's a couple generations, really.
Yeah.
So you mean as you're in your work as a criminal justice specialist, you were working with these women, or in
yes.
another capacity?
Well, because my expertise was in trauma, and my mother tongue is Serbo-Croatian, it kind of went hand in hand that way. So I basically work more with the clinical trauma piece of it. And I wanted to know how they would survive another catastrophic war in 100 years.
And now which war exactly are we talking about? Are we talking about the recent war in Bosnia? I mean, wasn't that going on when Clinton was in office?
Yes. It's what we term as the Balkan War. It was from
okay.
1991 to 1993.
Okay. But you said that area had been in a state of war for 100 years?
Well, I call it 100 years of war, so to speak. It was buried hatreds against other ethnic clans. Tito was able to keep peace for about 50 years, but it pretty much exploded into the genocidal war of the Balkan War in the 1990s. So
something what countries would those be? Just, you know, so it might help people get a sense of where we're talking about. We're talking about near Russia and Croatia, and what are those countries called now? Because didn't their names change?
Right. You know, the former Yugoslavia had states, so to speak, like the United States has. And the states we can call Croatia, Slovenia, Macedonia, Dalmatia, Serbia, and then Bosnia. And now they're all separate countries instead of being unified as, you know, Yugoslavia. However, Yugoslavia is more in Eastern Europe. And in fact, Serbia, Republic of Serbia, actually borders with, for instance, Bulgaria. However, our direct relationship is with Russia, which is further up to the north. And, well, I'll give you a very good example of that. The word Russia means northern Slavs, and Yugoslavia means southern Slavs.
Ah, okay.
And so our language is pretty much the same. It takes a while to talk it formally in Russian, but that we're both from the same language and the same tribe, so to speak.
And those people were really sort of always at war with one another, you know.
Yes.
Okay. And now you said it was your mother who was a Holocaust survivor.
Yes. Yes.
And so were we talking from World War II?
Yes.
Okay. And then what she immigrated to? She managed to survive, and she immigrated to the United States.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And how old were you, or were you even born yet?
I wasn't born yet. However, my other siblings were born in a displaced persons camp in Munich, Germany.
Okay.
So they actually came over on the boat through New York, all of that. So
through Ellis Island and that
yes.
whole thing. So,
mm-hmm.
So really, war has shaped your family's life for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
So, all right, so let's talk about the book. First of all, Blood and Honey. I think that title really rings a bell because of Brad Pitt's wife. Her name has just escaped me. Angelina Jolie.
Yeah.
There's an interesting thing you might want to say about that, right?
Yes. About 5 years ago, I had a writer and a film person that approached me and thought about doing a documentary on my work, and we looked for funding. Of course, we couldn't find it. However, since then, I guess it went through all the pipeline, and Angela Jolie took a lot of the material off of my website or what have you, I think. I'm not sure. But she also took another book. And there's no copyright on a book, by the way, and another book that's titled In the Land of Blood and Honey. However, I've been doing Blood and Honey, and I've been published since years before even that book, and I've done a lot of work around the term Blood and Honey, which, by the way, translates to Balkan. And
so Balkan means Blood and Honey?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so when we see this movie Angelina Jolie has done, you had already done something like this years prior,
right?
But they're
right.
The same. They're basically the same topic, though.
No, it takes it more from another book. It twists the real story. What happened is when the women I work with heard that she had done this, they said to me that. That's not the real ones. You do the real Blood and Honey stories. And in fact, there was a boycott with Women to Women and the president of the Women to Women group in Sarajevo. And Angela Jolie wouldn't meet with them. And I guess they ended up writing a letter to the UN asking her to be removed from her post in the UN. But the leader of that group in Sarajevo survived the rape camps, which is what the movie's about. But her sister died in those rape camps, and they objected to how the film was sensationalized, and it wasn't even close to what the real story was.
This movie that Angelina has made
right,
is not real
right.
accurate.
Yeah.
So if you want to read the real story, you read yours, Blood and
yes.
Honey. Okay. So now you say rape camps. I don't think maybe a lot of women in the United States understand even what that is. I mean, it sounds horrific, but what is it, and where did this happen?
Well, during the war, especially in Bosnia, they were the front lines to most of the war, although they were more from where I work, which is where the 1984 Winter Olympics occurred, in the mountains there. And they border more on the Croatian side. So it was mostly Croatian against Muslims. On the other side, towards Serbia, it was the Serbs against the Muslims. And this is both Eastern and Western Bosnia. So throughout Bosnia, you had these rape camps that were set up, and they would take women, especially educated women and even older women or women that had positions of power, and they would place them in these rape camps. And, well, a lot of them were killed, but they were brutally raped every day. It was really like a torture camp.
So
it culminated into the International Criminal Court finally saying in the late 1990s, as a result, that rape is a war crime.
Okay, so let me ask you a couple things about that. The first question is, you know, we read in history that, you know, there's always been women camp followers who followed soldiers. But we're not talking about that. We're literally talking about women held there against their will. Was it deliberately just to rape them, you know, rape as a means, as a weapon of war? Or
yes.
Was this for the, you know, for the pleasure of the soldiers, or a little bit of both?
It was a weaponry of war, and the way they systematically picked these women and put them in there. Thousands and thousands of them were interned in these rape camps. A good portion of them did not survive. And what happened is these women doctors, these women that had positions of power, were also in the rape camps. And what they did is they aborted the pregnancies. They had all their different ways of trying to circumvent them. I have yet to find a child of a war crime rape or a rape camp. There just isn't any.
Because they managed to be able to abort the fetuses.
Right. And
so
you had these very educated women and midwives and what have you that were placed in. They were pretty much targeted. They really took women that, you know, had some kind of control or had some kind of power in education, and they were systematically targeted.
Well, and also, too, wasn't this something about, you know, kind of, you know, maybe it's a several pronged, I mean, I'm guessing here, okay, so please feel free to correct me. Wasn't this also about genocide? Wasn't it about one people trying to obliterate another people by implanting their seed in their women so that, you know, it would be their people who would, you know, who would go on? Wasn't it that as much as it was trying to demean these women who I would assume were living lives that they felt were a little bit too liberated?
Maybe too liberated, but yes, the ethnic divides are kind of complicated. For instance, Croatians are basically of the religion that is Catholicism. So when you say Croatian or Hrvati, they're basically Catholic. Then you have the Serbians. The Serbians are, of course, South Slavic and the most related to the Russians. However, they are of the Serbian Orthodox faith. Okay, they were also targeted largely in World War II.
Is that also Christian?
Yes, that's Christian.
Okay.
And that's, my mother is a survivor of the World War II Serbian acts of genocide against them. And then you have the Muslims, and they were also targeted in World War II, World War I, and also in Bosnia to wipe out the Muslims. And so there was a deep hatred of the Muslims and their religion.
So this is another Christian versus Muslim thing happening.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But then you still had the Croatians against the Serbians and the Serbians against the Croatians. And then, of course, the Muslims would try to retaliate. But actually, it was between the Serbians and the Croatians that had most of the weaponry and the war in the background.
Okay.
Muslims were always, you know, economically or put in another category within the former Yugoslavia.
Okay, so we sort of set the scene with the players and the geography. Was there anything in particular that started you on the book, or was it just these women's incredible stories?
I'm forever changed. Every time I went there, And even when I did my mission for the International Criminal Court in Africa, Sri Lanka, I've gone, India, and I was just stunned by how these women, it was these women who would share a story, even if it was a recipe. And it was so heart-rending. I knew that I was standing in an intersection of some sort. And the common denominator between all these women and the Bosnian, like the female Muslim war crime survivors I work with, was they asked me to tell their story. That's all they wanted from me. As if they didn't exist unless I was to be able to tell their story. And I never even thought I could write a book or be an author. And I promised them. And that's why the book is here.
You need to do a vagina monologue kind of a thing. Seriously, you know, instead of look at the attention Eve Ensler, ended up with that's. I mean, this feels like it screams out for the same sort of thing.
Yes, and even then, I'll have to say that my book and their stories are the real vagina monologues. They're not done to sensationalize. I'm not going to be able to make money off of it, and if it does, I'm going to return it to them because it's theirs. It's their story. It's their lived experiences. I don't know how to explain that mutual exchange or that reciprocity that occurs, but you are taken. And my daughter is also into theater, and she is looking at doing, and she's done a couple of plays so far and written some plays just based on my book and my experiences there, especially with the Bosnian women. I'm just in awe of them. I don't know what else to say.
But now your experience went beyond the Bosnian women, right? You said you observed women in Africa, the Congo, the Sudan, Uganda, all of these women who were suffering the trauma of war.
I have to tell an amazing story like that. I was in Uganda, northern Uganda, with all the refugees, and I was teaching these social workers and facilitators, Ugandans, how to do my colo trauma format, but to have it engendered or, you know, feminist, so to speak. Very difficult with these refugees. So we were in the middle of nowhere in the bush country, and you have these huge mango trees where it's triple digit, but it's the only shade that you have there. And
triple digit heat, you mean?
Yes.
Heat, okay, all right.
Yes, sorry. And there is this older lady about my age, middle age, was looking at me and then motioned to my facilitator, translator, that they wanted to talk to me. And I said, sure, I'll talk to them on our way to go to this other village. And the next time I looked over there, and there must have been 80 women underneath these two huge mango trees, right? So I walk over there, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting. It's about 20 minutes, and I finally tell my facilitator, we have to get going. What do they want to say to me? And the leader told her to wait. And so I waited, and about another maybe 15 minutes, all of a sudden, all of these white doves flew overhead. It must have been 1,000 of them. And they rested on the branches above our heads. And I was in such awe of this. And she goes, that's the end of the meeting. Tell her that we're all here. And to remember, that's when you call a meeting.
I'm not sure I understand what happened.
Well, at first I didn't either. And then obviously she knew I was going to go meet with this other village, and that I was so much into the, I was so time consumed, how long it was going to take us there, how are we going to get there, how do we get back.
Yeah, the logistics. Yeah, sure.
Right. And that I didn't take in the surroundings. And so the doves must come there at a certain time every day.
Ah.
And that's their clock, and that's when we can all sit around and talk.
Oh, so that's sort of started the session then with it, when the doves. That is much more beautiful than maybe ringing a bell or saying, hey, you, come on, we're starting.
Yes, exactly. And so she was teaching me this etiquette.
I see. I see some cultural understanding there. All right. So you go to all of these countries. You start to have your awareness raised by all of these women who have been traumatized by war. Your own mother lived through that. So you've had this, you know, this essence filtering through your own family life. But you apparently these women have found a way to heal themselves. Is that what the this colo? I'm not sure what you call it. It's a dance or something, isn't it? That they do. Does that have something to do with their healing?
Yes, the word kolo is a very old Slavic word, and it means wheel, circle. And the kolo is a dance, a South Slavic dance, and they'll get up and they'll do these various kolo dances. They're really quite beautiful. And everyone, all the generations go in there and they dance, and they could do different dance steps, but they're always shoulder to shoulder. And it's almost like birds that go into a V formation. They just do it without instructions. And it's also to mean to be in a circle. And I have absolutely nothing. My nonprofit doesn't make any profit. It's pretty much non-profit, you know.
Yeah.
And when I went to Bosnia all this time, a lot of it was for my own money and some individual donations. And I really didn't have anything. And I was starting to think, wow, why am I doing this work? I have nothing. I'm not really a nonprofit. I can't get this money. I was wearing so many hats, and yet I knew trauma was the hat I should be wearing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there, and then one of the women came up to me and put a cassette tape in and says, oh, let's just dance the kolo. And there was so much healing after we were dancing the kolo. I sat back and I said, This is the trauma work. How did I not see this? So when we worked with the Srebrenica women, the Muslim women that lost all of their male relatives, over close to 10,000, and we went to go visit with them, it was a really heavy atmosphere. And I remember how we came back in our tattered little yellow bus back to, you know, Novi Travnik, Bosnia. It was about 6 hours away. And we stopped at this one little cafe, and they carried this cassette tape again of kolo dancing, and then we all got up and started to do this kolo dancing. And most of us were crying because there was nothing we can do for the Srebrenica women, so we decided that we would dance for them. And the healing of that trauma and the sense that how do we bear witness to something with our hands tied? And that with doing the kolo, it just brought this whole harmony and this healing. And all it was sharing our stories or being there and witnessing their own stories unfold. And then they always felt like they had existed instead of being erased or invisible.
So you're gonna have to explain this a little bit more to me. Forgive me. Sometimes I'm a little bit thick. I understand that you're conveying the beauty of these dances, and I think the solidarity possibly of the women. But after these women have been through such horrific things, you know, rape, losing their families, I'm sure most of them are destitute. You know, maybe they're living in camps with nothing, probably not even food and clean water sometimes. Is it just because they have nothing but the dance, you know? How does the dance heal something so horrendous?
It's something they can do, the dance. Right now they have, on Friday nights, you know, during the summer, they have this kolo dancing, and everyone comes in, homeless, anyone, and they just dance side by side. They become a real community. Or it's when we're in a circle. So what happened is the group of women that I was working with, the Novi Travnik, goes to all these other communities, and they just join in a circle, and they talk with each other. They bring coffee. If they have extra money, they also bring their cookies or, you know, food and groceries for all these other women that are in need or, you know, just be able to share, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they practice the kolo not just in a dance step, but being in a circle together. And
okay.
Then forming this community. So the whole idea of the Kolo dance is basically an algorithm or a memory that's triggered within them that even if you can't dance it, the fact that you can be in a circle is the wheel of life, and it creates this community. And therefore, one of the emergent properties that happens when women sit together and share their existence and the wisdom of their experiences, it's they heal.
I see. Why do you think the trauma of these women has? If I'm living under a rock, you just tell me I'm living under a rock.
No,
but we just
it's
don't
wonderful.
Hear about this. We don't hear about this.
Well, you know, I guess I've been really full on in doing this. I've been so immersed into it, and they're all my professors, so I would always go back and forth, and I really had what I call a poetic college with these women, not just in Bosnia, but, you know, Chad, Uganda, I've been in Sudan, the Congo, and even in Sri Lanka and in India. And I'm just full on in that. But you have to look at society as a whole. What we do is women are of secondary status. And if you have poverty and if you are, you know, not of some kind of measure of wealth or kind of background, you just don't exist.
So you're insignificant. So that's
right.
So when Clooney goes over to Africa, and forgive me, I don't know what country,
Sudan.
I can't remember, the Sudan. When he goes over there, he's bringing a little bit of attention to, I guess, with things that are happening. I mean, there's stuff on the YouTube now about, you know, kids are learning about Kony, the warlord.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, we're still not hearing the stories of women. I mean, except
right.
for maybe Nicholas Kristoff and his wife, you know, half the sky, but that's
right.
not even what you're talking about, I don't think.
No, and because unless we view women as victims or, you know, victims of rape and war crimes and atrocities, it's this horrific statistics, and that's all we want them to remain as.
Right.
But we'll never look at females, women, and their children as real people, whereas I work in that. So I work in what is insignificant, and who really cares to know about it? Even when I do a lot of presentations or even a radio show like this or what have you, most people think it's depressing or, you know, I'm glad
well,
you do this work.
It's reality. You know, it's reality. And, I mean, light needs to be shed on this and the suffering of these women and their children because, like you said, this is intergenerational.
Yes.
You know, and that's significant too, you believe, right? That it's not just, you know, this intergenerational trauma part of it.
You know, there's a lot of Serbian or South Slavic kind of sayings about that. And there's a chapter in my book, and I call it maternal fright, where the mother, if she has fright while she's pregnant or even when she conceives the child, that all she does is bring the war again and the violence again. That the child is taught through her blood and then through her milk.
That's what you meant, it's in the DNA.
Yes. But that's a very old saying, so to speak.
Yeah.
The whole chapter talks about this maternal fright. And
so are you talking metaphor, or do you think there's literally some, you know, truth to it?
Well, I think they're metaphors, just like the dance algorithms
mm-hmm.
and how the dance means the kolo for them and the circle and these metaphors that they have in terms of sayings are basically a succinct description of what is biological. So
okay.
basically her story is the biology.
I get it. We have two people that just popped up on the switchboard. They might just be listening, but they might have a question. Do you mind if I ask if they'd like to ask you a question?
No problem.
All right, let's see. Hang on. Hi, listener from the 602 area code. Did you have a question for us?
Yeah, I have a question and a statement.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Should I start now?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, to the host, on one of her comments. Oh, okay. On one of the comments that host is asking, when she said rape is these rape camps are for the pleasure of the soldiers, I have to say that's a disturbing statement. It should be rape is never about pleasure, it's about power. And the other thing I have to say with Danica, I think she's trying to do a lot of work as one person, or maybe a minority of people in this area. And I commend her for going to these places and doing this work and being of the Slavic descent, the South Slavic descent. I'm Serbian. There's plenty of blame to go around on this war issues. But the reason that this doesn't get into the mainstream media is because it's politicized. And when you're a minority, you don't get a lot of press. You get, look how long it took black people in our own country to be recognized, you know, 100 years, 50 years, and we're no further along if you look at the case in Florida today.
Yeah.
But I think that my question for Danica would be, what would really help move her forward? Obviously, donations. And I'd like her to touch on that, maybe for the viewers or people that are going to come back and listen to this, and give us some information about where people could go and donate to her to help her get women in Europe to stick together. And like she was saying about the colo, it's a circle. It's almost the circle of life. So I would like to know more about and have her get some fundraising going, because I think it's a very important issue.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberta Lamayich, and you're from Phoenix.
Hello.
Go ahead.
He wanted you to talk more about the colo and where people could send donations.
Well, my colo, I have a website, and it actually has PayPal on that, and it is www.kol, and then the word collaboration together is one word, colocollaboration.org.
Okay.
And you can check out the stories and what have you. I also think that a donation can be having your time, having you come with me on one of the trips there, and just being a female shoulder to shoulder, sharing their stories and your stories with them. I think that's just as invaluable.
Okay.
Go there. Just go there and do it.
Well, and I do want to clarify. I'm not sure if the listener misunderstood what I intended when I made the statement, the pleasure of the soldiers. Of course, we know, rape is it's an act of power over another. It's an act of violence. But what I was referring to is, you know, it's known that often, women are used for the, for the sexual gratification of, their oppressor. You know, it's not like they're willing participants, and that's what I was referring to. So I'm not sure if he misunderstood, but I just wanted to clarify that.
She made a good point, but I knew what you were intending to speak about. And yes, I think when the men, organize these rape camps, it was for their own pleasure, but it was, like how you said, a genocidal, what I call actually gynocidal approach to the problem, where we can shame them, we can destroy their, ethnic background.
Right,
and
right.
Their culture. So I understood how you linked that together, but
yeah.
I also understood how the listener might interpret that and only hear that part of it.
Yeah, he only
hear
heard the word pleasure. I think
right.
He only heard the word pleasure. We have one other person on the switchboard here. Let me see if they had a question, a quick question.
All right.
Hi, from the 705 area code. Did you have a question, or were you just listening?
I'm just listening. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, Denise, we probably have about 10 minutes left, unless my second guest calls in a little bit late. What are the important things we haven't spoke about so far that you want to get across in this interview?
Well, I think that the main thing that I see when I go across into international zones and I work with women that, no, regardless of their background, their religion, or even if their language is different, that somehow I find this solidarity amongst women. And the beauty of this is that those that have healed and healed terrible atrocities and war crimes, these women, the universal statement they say to me is this: I don't want you to ever experience what I have. And it's not out of hatred. It's not out of judgment. It's not out of any kind of that perpetuation, of hatred that goes international or even intergenerational or transgenerational. It's this sense of, how can I make sure that this experience is not repeated again and again?
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of their status, regardless of their education, this is mirrored constantly. But then that's when I feel this, or I have a glimpse of this female solidarity. But when I move away from it and when I go back into the other world or when I do my consulting and what have you, and then I hear the same kind of rape stories everywhere, war and even within the military and all these other types of things, it is being repeated. And then when I look about, I see how women are not in solidarity with each other. There's this competition. There's also this denial. There's this, separation that occurs.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at what's happening here in the United States is, women are, battling the Republicans to keep their dignity and their rights. You have women who, we call them the handmaidens of the patriarchy, like the Handmaid's Tale. I mean, they're in collusion. They're complicit in their own oppression.
And, I see that so much. And it's almost to the point where they'll do anything. Basically, I love Mary Condren's, I'll never forget this quote that I read in one of her books. And she said that we will kill the very woman whose strength could save us all. Women will kill her.
So what do you, have you come to any conclusions or, have you studied any scholars that that maybe explain why it is women can't stand in solidarity? We're the majority on the planet. You would think we ought to be able to get our shit together.
I just love that. I think sometimes we do, but we don't. We'll do it on a single or a segmented way. But we don't know how to connect with other women. And I think once we do the uprising, so to speak, or when we arise, I just have to look at Arab Spring. I just have to look at the women that I work with in Bosnia or the women that I worked with in Uganda and the Congo, Chad, and even Sri Lanka. And they may be small little communities, but they started rising, and they really started to heal their own communities. And they're still perpetuating it. But the Arab, spring is, it's another thing where I think women are starting to put their foot down. And I'm hoping that here in the States that we will look at our sisters from across the waters and say, enough. When we look at the environment, let's look at even at Fukushima, the radiation. When we look at all the wars, I'm waiting for the women, especially Western women, to at least overcome their indoctrination and their hatred of them, of their own female sex, and be in a circle together. And I think then we'll come to that. I can't change the world, but you know what I did? I decided to change my world, and when I looked up, the whole world changed.
Well, they say, it starts with each of us, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, what do you believe has been erased from female lives in a world of such violence?
We no longer honor or value her.
Okay.
I mean, when you look across the world and we have all of these catastrophic statistics and we don't want to hear the stories and they're insignificant, how much do we really value the female gender? And then how you said about what's happening here with the Republican Party or whatever, we have abortion laws against her as if she can't even make up her own mind. Her own body is not even hers.
I know. Well, you, I read an article before you were actually able to call in that had been posted on the Huffington Post about this, you know, that this very subject, 10 Reasons the Rest of the World Thinks the U.S. is Nuts, you know, detailing all, you know, I mean, there's been over 1,100-plus bills since Republicans took control in so many Congresses across the country November before last that have, I mean, they got into office promising they were going to do something about jobs, and all they have done is focus on cultural issues, on social issues, on women, and women in unions, women and workers. You know, they've been, you know, at war against. And really, when, whether it's workers or whether it's women, it's about taking away people's power.
Well, it's not just people's power. They start with the females. So I love with what Wisconsin did. All those teacher unions came in, and they're mostly women. And, I mean, they're still playing out that and
yeah.
what they're orchestrating in the state of Wisconsin. I just think that I think there's going to be more and more of that. If we can't keep pushing women around, but I'm hoping that we'll see the clarity, whether it's going to help, you know, I don't know, or if it'll be too late, we'll have to see. All I know is that I have to do meaningful work.
Absolutely.
I'm only accountable to myself and how I can, you know, carry through this vow to these women to tell their stories. But I can't own them. I can't
well,
own their stories.
That. About that, I'm just wondering, and if, I know you're only one person, so forgive me. I don't mean to give you one more thing to put on your plate, but I guess I just wonder if, and maybe you've even already done this, and I don't know, and we haven't talked about it yet, but you see what has happened with how that the story of Coney has gone viral on YouTube. Do you have any of these women on film that you could put little clips together on YouTube? I mean, that might also bring in some donations.
Yeah, it's very dangerous. When I go with the International Criminal Court to the Congo, I worked on that case where we put away, finally, about 2 years ago, and that's after so many missions to the Congo that we did, where we put away one of the LRA for that. Of course, we didn't get Coney. But for me to even carry a camera, and I do have pictures on my website, and I have some more pictures that I have of these women, and I do, you know, give little information about that, I first have to honor and give them dignity as far as, you know, I have a concern that all we do is have these videos and clips of these sensationalizing victims, so to speak. And I would rather have it done through their narratives as opposed to, you know, how the media and other people crave for it.
Well, it's just that people don't like to read today, you know. I mean, it just seems like we're the visual generation, you know, the film generation rather than the readers. As unfortunate as that is, myself as a writer, believe me, you know, I wish more people would pick up a book. But,
right.
you know, unfortunately so many don't. You know, if it's not on a video clip, then maybe it's less likely they're going to see it. But you're saying their lives could be in danger, right?
Well, their lives could be in danger, yes, because even for a lot of witnesses that we do for the International Criminal Court, a lot of them don't ever survive it or the whole ordeal because somehow word gets out and there you have it. But even for myself, when I go into these places and I'm taking pictures or cameras, I become a target. So the pictures that I take, trust me, they were done under great risk.
I see.
And if I bring a video camera, I'm even And it's not that I'm afraid, but, you know, I'm usually with others at that time. And then I also think of the witnesses or the women that I'm going to be videotaping. And all of a sudden, that's all through YouTube, let's say, or what have you. They can be identified.
I see. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Give me 1 second. I want to make sure our second guest knows that I see him on the switchboard and let him know I'm going to get to him in just a minute.
Okay.
Lee, is that you?
It is indeed. Hi, Kat.
Okay, Lee, I'll be right with you. Just give me a couple minutes to wrap up with Danica, and we'll be starting our chat.
Great. Sounds good.
Okay. Well, Danica, as we wrap it up, why don't you give your website again, and
okay.
If there are any closing comments you'd like to make about, because we didn't really get a chance to say too much about the Kolo, the dance. Is there, on your website, is it possible to see the dance being done or anything of that nature?
Yes, there is. There's some pictures, and I'm in the process of updating it. I have someone working on that right now. But my website is www.kolocollaboration.org, and you can contact me there at info@kolocollaboration.org. You can review all the stories there. My book will be out at the end of May, and same with the second book that I'll have, and I'll have additional stories. And the way it's done, it's an e-book, so it's actually quite colorful, and it's I have a couple of videos embedded in that, so I did part of that.
Okay.
And then there are some pictures. So there are words, but there are also some pictures and some videos about it. And if we all just did one small act today to whatever female and really ask her her narrative, her story, I think we'll all get there relatively quickly.
Okay. And if we do see the Angelina Jolie movie, Blood and Honey, is there anything we should keep in mind?
If you want the real Blood and Honey stories, please check out my book and the website and listen to these other women. And to remember, it was boycotted by the women in Bosnia themselves. They refused to see the movie. And actually, there's, a couple of lawsuits that are occurring with that movie. I don't know much about it.
Okay. Is there any? Well, you don't really know if there's anything we can take away from it that, in terms of its accuracy.
No, because I haven't seen it, and I've been so busy doing all my other work that I haven't had the time to even go through it.
Okay.
So.
Well, I want to thank you for the work you're doing in the world there. I think you've probably brought some information to my listeners they probably didn't know a whole lot about. And even though these poor women have been through horrific circumstances, it's hopeful to know that they've found a way to heal themselves and their communities and their children.
Yes, thank you very much, and thank you for doing this interview. And it helps me to process and to repeat the stories and to keep improving on my narrative for it.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm glad to know that you're out there in the world. And if there's any new developments and you want to come back on the show and share that with listeners, if you need to get the word out about anything, please don't hesitate to email me. We'll definitely do it, okay?
Oh, great. When my books come out, I'll let you know.
Okay,
all right.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Karen. All
you're
right.
Welcome. Good
Bye-bye.
Night. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking, the feminine consciousness. And I like to say, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, it's these new values, these benchmarks that have the substance to save the world. You've just been listening to Danica Anderson discussing her book, Blood and Honey, The Secret History of Women, the story. Stories of the women in Slavic countries who've learned to heal themselves and their communities after the trauma of just generations of catastrophe and war. So, Next up, we have Lee McCloskey as we cross the threshold into the second part of the show. Lee is what I refer to as a true Renaissance man. I believe he's a role model of what men might look like and act like post-patriarchy. He's an actor, a prolific writer, an artist, and he's the founder and caretaker of Olander, what I call a Temple of Sophia in Malibu, California, which is a sight to behold, let me tell you. I have the honor of going there and experiencing it, and it is awesome, and I can't even find the words, quite frankly. It's a temple within his home known as the Hieroglyph of the Human Soul, which had its inception September 11, 2001. It's a work of art, creativity, and reflection of the sacred feminine from floor to ceiling, as art literally covers every inch of wall space, furniture, books, ceiling of his library, which Lee refers to as the Wonder Studio. Lee is the author of many books. Some of these are the titles. Tarot Revisioned, with a card set of his major arcana. Then there's In the Splendor, which is a revealed mythic story of creation, lover yearning for the beloved and the holy DNA weaving Venus and Sophia. There's Adam Reborn and Eve Restored, a romance in two parts. There's the Codex for Winter Solstice, Summer Solstice, and Tor Equinox, the Mysterium Magnum Grail. But our theme tonight is the mythic and heroic feminine as revealed in the art tarot and visual philosophy of Leigh McCloskey. So, Leigh, I welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Karen. It's delightful to talk with you.
Well, I'm so glad you were able to take time tonight. I know you have a big event there at Olander, so thank you for taking time to share your work with listeners. And, you know, as I was saying, the first time I went to Olander, someone told me, oh, you have to go see Lee's place, but never in my wildest dreams was I prepared for what I saw there. Why don't you talk about the space a bit and how you were inspired to start it. What inspired you? And tell us about that mysterious connection you believe is between 9/11 and your work and your tarot.
It's a wonderful that you asked me that. I was astounded when I spent 17 years working on the tarot. I began it in 1985, and around the turn of the century, I was reworking the world archetype, and I noticed that it was dated 9/11/1986, and it has twin towers in it, and it has to do with the planet Saturn, or the falling away of the old binary of what I call the false erections of the secular and religious brothers, one who says, I must be obeyed because I own everything, and the other says, I must be obeyed because I have God and you don't. And between that binary, this pulse, we see in the drawing itself the emergence of the divine feminine, and she is seen really as a great tree growing from all worlds. And her story was that what was occurring in the species mind was a falling away of the old binary architecture, to reveal the deep sacred, meaning going from the secular to the religious, and finally returning home to the sacred. And so she says, you are a great tree that lives in all worlds. When you know this, you turn the illusion of death upside down and open the inner eye of vision, wisdom, and knowing. What becomes very important is that when we think of the tarot, it's a wheel. And when I was working on the tarot, and it did come full circle finally, I started to understand that it was a bit like having built a piano. The drawings are in black and white, and so it was looking at the nature of the psyche, what we would think of as what are the differences between things, what are the differences between the notes, and so each of the drawings had a unique note, a unique character. Why the 9/11 became so important was that 15 years to the day of that world archetype drawing, the towers came down on 9/11. And when you talked about the room, that began on 9/11/2001. And I didn't expect it to become what it's become. As a matter of fact, I had no conceit. It was just a language spontaneously emerged. called the Watcher language. And what the Watcher language is the repeating of a figure over and over and over again. But from this repeated figure, like cells creating a body, every larger form is built of this weave of entity. And the first entity to emerge in this process on my floor was Kuan Yin. And Kuan Yin started to speak to me through this process that we were returning home, that the falling away of the illusion of the secular and the religious, the sense that we are not that, is falling away, and that we're returning, the waters are returning home to the domestic space, to the intimate space. And this also has to do, of course, with the deep feminine, because she says, I arise where you are true to the intimacy of your soul and knowing, not where you're trying to convince another of that which you don't believe yourself. And so that's why I started to understand that the 9/11 symbolism really had to do with the movement of creating from 1986, interestingly enough, when the world archetype was drawn, until 2008 when the studio or the hieroglyph of the human soul came full circle. I'm still working on it, but it really came full circle at that point, at that year, and I realized that that was a 22-year cycle, just like the 22 keys of the major arcana of the tarot. And it started to tell me that what has occurred over the years from 86 to 08 was a process of individuation in the human psyche that would finally realize that it wasn't going to be a politician or a messiah or aliens that came to save us, one more benevolent parent source that says, you are not it, I'm here, you must follow me. But we would finally stand in the center of our experience and understand that we must bring to the conversation of what does it mean to be human, not what we think will impress someone else, but the true story that comes from our heart. We must be true to our intimate story. And that's the deep and profound thing for me, is that this hieroglyph of the human soul, the Sophia Temple, as you call it, which I just love, emerged within the domestic space, and it's mythic, so it's the mythic domestic, meaning that finally we're being told that we are the outcome of a great question, and that the painted studio that I have been living in and working on is a great cave painting. So it takes us back to the beginning, where it's paint, imagination, and storytelling. And it puts us there, and when I was working with Sophia, she said, you see, you left the cave, and it was empty. You left, but the question was, who are you? What does it mean to be human? What are our responsibilities one to another? And in this great question, across the ages, we've gathered this living library, because upstairs as well is a library. So it's telling me that the library is finally saying, although you hold a unique identity as yourself, you are now woven of this great identity of being human. As I say, we think we have personal psychology. We have human psychology we experience personally, and that we are all whole and holy and holographic. And that's why even the room upstairs, as you know, you put on 3D glasses and the floor becomes water. It becomes, you're looking down into depth. It becomes multidimensional. And yet you are what is in motion. It's fixed.
Well, now, Lee, I want to direct some of my listeners to your website, because I believe it's so hard for to convey the beauty and depth and intricacy of what you've created without actually seeing the pictures.
Absolutely.
But yeah. but you do have some pictures on your website that that people can get some glimpses of the incredible creation you have there, don't you?
Yes, and that's www.leemcloskey.com. It's just my name, .com. And
it's L-E-I-G-H, L-E-I-G-H, not L-E-E.
Yeah, L-E-I-G-H-M-C-C-L-O-S-K-E-Y.com. And if they could look, I really, because, of course, a picture is worth a thousand words, and what I am saying in words was not something I've illustrated with the paintings, but rather when they look at the paintings, realize that what I'm trying to express in words is coming directly from the experience of the paintings, which is why it has been so significant for me in this assertion of the deep feminine and the story that we are returning home and finally understanding that, that it is intimate space that we are seeking now to honor.
So what you're saying is we're leaving behind the secular, we're leaving behind the indoctrination of religion, and we are starting to once again understand the importance of just the sacred, maybe the spiritual in our life. Is that what you're summing up?
Yes, and what is very important for me in terms of this is because it's coming from the art, and I point out that art is the language of spontaneous creation, meaning that it is like what we are from as human beings. We are born of spontaneous creation and love, and art for me is the same energy. So it's actually the story and language of creation that's revealing that what we have overlooked, because we have been so far away from the knowledge of the mother, the knowledge of nature, that we think that God works in strange and mysterious ways, and not really. This is not true. What we have overlooked is that we are organic, that we are like a tree. As a matter of fact, I'm informed that we are ancient trees, and that we are growing from very ancient roots, and that as every organic process shows us, seed to plant, and finally, in terms of the flower, it buds and then finally flowers. And what this is telling me in terms of the art or the language of creation is that we are, in terms of the movement of who and what we are as human, now capable of holding both unique identity and the knowledge of our greater energy. And this is something that we've actually been preparing for. And I think it will help us make sense of, well, why has it been so difficult to be human? Why has it been such, in a sense, a merciless age for so very long? Why have people suffered so greatly? Why do we have such self-loathing and incompleteness and a sense of failure? And what the environment is telling me is that it's because we have been traveling to the West to self-reflection, unique identity, and we've finally gotten to the place where, and it says this literally in the studio, that we can go no further in that direction. And that's where we are now, is that we are realizing there's nowhere to get to. And in terms of that, what it will do is turn us back into the conversation that maybe we're now being asked to create a different set of assumptions about the purpose of our journey. Because if we create a more loving understanding of why we've been going through this difficulty, I'm convinced we will start to free up this deeper feminine knowing. And she says, I am the mother. I love all of my children. I say there are no evil atoms. If you don't like the stories you're telling, tell better stories. I, as the mother, do not give you permission to brutalize any of my children, nor to exterminate any of them. I love them all. It is up to you to create a story that allows you to live according to the truth that is within you rather than a truth you're trying to convince your neighbor of.
So, Lee, are you saying that what we're coming to as we come back to the sacred, come back to the spiritual, come back to the mother, is that we're also coming back to understand our interconnection, to maybe reconnect to the idea of, could it be as simple as love?
Absolutely. It is as simple as love and as absolutely remarkable as love. And as a matter of fact, in the studio, when you stand at this right angle to the mirror and to Sophia, and you look down, you'll see this face of Christ and the blind eye leading towards self-reflection and an open eye being the knowledge of love. And it started to tell me that we can look at it mythically, that the knowledge of the Father is, I think, therefore I am, and the knowledge of the Mother is, I love, therefore I am. And that the two hemispheres, the brain of thought and love, have been, like male and female, really canceling each other's wave out, meaning that it has been dominance and repression and suppression. But I see now that what it is saying is that there is the strength of love is now to say, I love, therefore I am. I think, therefore I am. I am born of the mother, I am born of the father. So therefore, I can allow how I think to finally be once again at the service of love. I no longer have to use thought to separate and say, how am I different from you? I can finally once again use my thinking to say, when I return home, I start to realize when it is family, it's not who's above and who's below. It's how do we live together? How do we get along? How do we make this journey together?
Well, what I'm hearing you say, too, is what so many of us in the goddess community have been saying for so long as we try to, you know, rebirth the sacred feminine in the world. And I'm sure other people have said it using different, different language as well. But it comes back to this idea of us finding that yin and yang, that balance between the left and the right brain, the masculine and feminine within ourselves.
Yes. Because if you look at that in terms of lover and beloved, you know, as I say, the psyche wants to have a fine tango with itself. You know, it doesn't want it to be one or the other. I actually feel, and this is the graphic story from the hieroglyph, because it tells us that that the ancients knew that we came from vastness. We didn't come from nothingness. We came here to forget what we once knew, and that this planet, which was far away from the center of things, actually could sustain the illusion of separation, meaning that like a radio, the closer you're into the source, the harder, almost impossible it is to have that illusion that there's separation between things. But that we came here, and that the first key was to in the time of the mother, and this is why when we see our ancient civilizations, it's all about fertility and the womb and fecundity. You know, we have the mounds in Ireland and, of course, all of the different grottos and caves, and because we really wanted to remember. We did not want to forget, like planting a seed very deep, because we knew that once we turned a corner to what this planet offered, which was the capacity to forget even this, and to finally, what I realized, because this is what my painting is telling me, is that we blossomed creation, meaning that in ancient times we all knew ourselves and one another. Essentially, if you and I were part of an ancient time, as I would see your pride for me if I did something well, that's where I would live. You know, it would be for the family, for the tree, for the sense of connection. We are in this together. But when we turned the corner, we started to think, how am I different from you? How am I not you? How am I separate? And, of course, this is where the blame of woman became, sorrowful, because she was blamed for this separation that was essentially the psyche itself starting to understand how can we pull out. You know, if you think about Beethoven or Michelangelo or really these different great arts that we've brought forth, they are not the arts that were brought forth from a sense of connection. They were brought forth from this dread that maybe there's really nothing to connect to. Maybe we are abandoned. Maybe we are just in this sort of nihilistic nightmare of nothing adds up to anything. And I almost feel like that if you think of it from a psychological point of view, that like a maturing individual, finally you go, well, maybe even if that's true, I'll at least add something to the story, because I don't need to just die thinking it's meaningless. I need to put something in that helps add meaning. And I think that's why Joseph Campbell and so many of the people that are about myth and archetype really are saying that the artist must reinvigorate the myths, because that's when we don't look at things culturally or socially, but start to say maybe the saga and the sorrows of our human story are the outcome of a great sweep of consciousness that didn't include just one body in time, but numerous bodies across, you know, numerous ages. And we finally built the strength to hold this capacity to be both separate and connected, and that, as I say, then returns us to lover and beloved, because I get this feeling that we left as children, we now return as worthy beloveds. And to me, that's the key to the feminine. She says, I am not an entitlement, and that those who are chosen are not chosen as an elite group. They have chosen to become worthy. Do you know, we've reversed this in these last thousands of years, but why I think it's so important is that it is this, as going back to just what you started with, love. It's love that will transform us, because we can actually hold the true force and enormous responsibility of love.
Well, let me go back to something you started to talk about, and then you digressed a little bit. If I've misunderstood something you said, feel free to correct me. I think what I was hearing you say is something that we talk about in goddess spirituality. Is sort of like the we versus the I. You know, within goddess culture, it was very much we were the we. We all sort of depended on one another. And then things started to shift, and it became about the individual and the I. Does that sound like something you were sort of tapping into a little bit?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. It was almost a comedy routine of, you know, because I'm a guy, and I turn the corner and see my reflection in a mirror. I don't know what it is because I've never been self-reflective before. I've always seen myself in the eyes of another. So what do? I think it's God, of course, and I'm delighted that God's a guy, because it turns out that reflection, when I'm angry, that reflection is angry too, so God must be just like me, an angry God, always having a sense of incompleteness, and doesn't he stand at that corner and say, I'm the one God, there are no other gods before me, I don't have a mother, a wife, or a sister? You know, essentially, he declares, and I think that was the declaration of the ego, taking this stepping out into the I, and you're right, it did begin as the I, you know, moving from the I, vision, into the I of the ego. And mm-hmm. That's why I feel that it is I and we, in the sense that we can hold I and we. You can put it essentially the I and I, my unique identity and my unique vision, now like an embodied actor, say, let me bring my excellence to this larger weave, this larger conversation, and the we will be the play, the sense that together as humans we're capable of a much more interesting version of who and what we think we are.
Well, you know what I'm thinking too, and forgive me, maybe it's just my headspace, Lee, and if you don't feel comfortable taking the conversation in this direction, feel free to say so, and we'll go back to the flowery and the metaphor. But, you know, when I hear about the we versus the I, I can't help but compare it to what's playing out in society today, you know, what's playing out in the politics. You know, it's sort of like you look at the left, and, you know, the left is sort of about the we, you know, and you look at the right, and it feels like it's the Ayn Rand stuff. It's all about the I and the me. And I wonder, and I bring that up because as we think we're evolving, and, you know, we all talk about, well, we think, you know, things are moving faster, and maybe we're sort of escalating to some sort of change for humanity. I wonder if this feels so tangible, if this is so in our face right now, if it is also intense, this battle between the we, where we care about the tribe and we care about the community, versus the them who are the, you know, the I's, who just care about the me and everybody else be damned. It almost feels like that too is playing out this epic struggle and just this, you know, monumental, you know, proportion. Do I just have politics on the brain?
No, not at all. And as a matter of fact, I think that when we look at the political structure from a mythic or really even the transition from ages, from the Piscean or the age of patriarchy into, or separation, into the time of the Aquarian, the time of the blossoming, the time of ensemble, we start to realize that there's been an audience and a performer's brain on the planet. One says the play is done, let's sit in the seats, and those who have the best seats win. There's nothing we can do about it. And there's others that get here and say, well, wait a minute, no, the play is malleable. The condition isn't a given. It's every time, almost like Groundhog's Day. It seems like bad ideas proliferate every age. You can't do away with them by shouting them down. But they seem to create almost a type of, they're mentors of a type of Aikido of consciousness. It says the whole key is to not identify with one side or the other as the prime example in a sense, siding with something, but again, using the alchemy of opposition to finally go from thesis, antithesis, synthesis, or the secular, religious, into the sacred. And that's why even when I work with it's called Revelations in Pink, Mothership, which is part of the hieroglyph, her story is, and it's physical, but she does say, you stand in her, and she says, I embrace the right, I embrace the left, there are no evil atoms, all is energy. If you don't like the stories you're telling, tell better stories. And her, and the, what she's saying is that all changes in consciousness are grown. Use the fury that comes from some of the things that are going on, but realize it's a bit like standing in an insane asylum. After a while, you know, you get angry at the guy calling himself Napoleon, and after a while you think, you know, he really does think he's Napoleon. I realize he's not Napoleon, so is my anger at him going to actually transition or change him at all? No. So maybe what I have to do is go about what I need to get done, and I think that the metaphor now is, because I feel that the hieroglyph, I actually feel that the Sophia Temple, this sense of intimate domestic space where we live and love and raise family, where we tell the story that, that is the story we can live with rather than telling our neighbors how they're supposed to live, I really do believe that out of these almost victory gardens, out of these small growths where women are gathering and saying, you know what, we're not agreeing to a male-dominant archetype anymore, and it's over. It's not as though we're going back on that. This is over. That's why I really see that, that why things are so exaggerated now is it's really like the old dragon is full of fire and fury but hollow and dying, and that the point in its eruptions to really use the fuel then to say, let me stay on point, let me stay on my task. And whether six people are interested in what you're doing, 60 or 6 million, it really doesn't matter. Numbers do not matter at this point, I'm convinced, but rather because I realize that the knowledge of the feminine is the knowledge of energy. The knowledge of the masculine in us is the knowledge of form. And we've been studying form. So our masculine tendency in both male and female is to try and figure out a form that will resolve the problem of energy. And I know as a storyteller that the only thing that will actually give us spaciousness that can actually allow for this transformation is to keep adding to the possibility that we are blossoming, that when we say we must learn to say yes rather than yikes. You know, just in terms of our own inner mental and emotional struggle. I just feel that you know, don't get angry, get busy, because we are the future. I just know this from my love of history and evolution and all these different things, is that this old way of thinking is in its last desperate acts, and that's why the acts themselves are so absurd so often, where you just are looking at the ceiling going, you're kidding.
So you're saying your best advice is for those of us who are just outraged is to, you know, get out there and be the change we want to be, continue to do what it is we do, and I guess sort of don't give the other side much energy.
Because when you give the other side energy, you're making it an equal. You know, you're actually saying this is a relevant perspective.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to this is a spur that then will make me do the work I'm meant to do. I'm not going to react. Because when we look at history, you realize that you can look at the dark figures or people that are manipulating and this and that and say, well, that's so-and-so or that's such-and-such in our particular world. But then you look through history and say, wait a minute, that character like Iago or Richard III is always with us. So the question is, if that's true then, how do you actually, in a sense, work with enough subversiveness to do your work? And that's why I feel that the whole point we're being asked to realize is that you can't fight the surveillance system. You can't fight so many things that just know how to do this way of doing business much better than any of us. But, you know, that's, I took a page from the early Christians. They understood you couldn't fight the Romans. The only thing you could do was what? Gather in homes. And as we know, it was to a great degree, many, many women. And with Christ himself, he was surrounded by women. You know, and I really feel that they understood the domestic key. They said, if we try and make an institution out of this, they're going to kill us. But if we meet at home and we just tend to the possibility that maybe, whether master or slave, every human being has innate dignity. If we stick to that talking point, who knows what might happen?
I
feel that maybe that seed wasn't yet, like democracy, ready. It didn't have the, you know, sort of requisite maturity from the species yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go through all the dark side and downside of that through the age
mm-hmm.
of Pisces. But now we're preparing, as the Maya say, for the age of flowers or blossoming. And
I see what you're saying. So you're saying keep the teaching, keep putting the energy out there, the sacred feminine, and it'll at a point it will reach your critical mass, and by virtue of its own popularity, people's own enlightenment, wanting a better, different life, it will win the day.
Yes, because men and women, like I would say, if anything, there's an exhaustion. It's almost like where people have been shouting and there's a. And just people are saying I can't even be angry anymore. I can't, you know, I know a lot of you know, just with men and women saying, I'm not going to make my life about reacting to the bad ideas of others. I'm going to take the bad ideas of others as a catalyst for doing what I consider right action, what I consider actually a healing story. That's one of the reasons why I feel that the metaphor of my home is so important, because Olindar, which is the name of my home, and Olindar Foundation for Emerging Renaissance, or OFFER, which I created as really a type of thought form, meaning that I wanted to put into the blood, you know, the mixture of the human, you know, sort of DNA. I said, well, let me create a possibility of Renaissance simply by declaring it. And then I started to also realize that you know, because I had worked for many, many years professionally as an actor in the outer world, professionally, and so I knew that world. And so I protected my inner world, my private world, because that's where the conversation that was nourishing, that was healing, I could actually hold. And I realized it wasn't interested in that other world. So it let me, in a way, grow the garden that I've been growing for so long, privately, intimately. But I feel that that's actually going to end up being the non-local strength, is that as mothers teach their daughters to treat themselves with dignity and to realize that they are the mother of generation, that within them beats the heart of creation, that they are the first principle, they are life, and therefore their mathematics is not to abstract but to bring forth wholeness, holiness. Believe me, I believe women who are brought up knowing that a relationship to their own truth, not a bias, not an opinion, but their own truth, they will simply embody an energy that will no longer allow a type of overgrowth of what you would have to say the dark story of brutality. You know, and I feel like that's why everything is so, in a way, reaching a type of crescendo at this point.
Right.
You know, it's because you look around and you think, It's beyond horrific in certain things that are being done, and but I just feel it's
the last gasps.
I feel it's going to come from. Yeah, I even thought, I was listening, you know, I realized that Olindar, which I'd named from a dream, my home, because I told my girls Olindar stories, and we'd go to the ancient library of Olindar, but I realized Olindar, even the pun of that, was all under, and I thought, oh, like. Planting seeds of ideas that finally nourish a sense of man and woman that turns them back into lover and beloved, and turns man away from bowing before outward authority and becoming a coward, you know, becoming soldiering on, but never living a life that actually related to the love he felt in his heart. I mean, this is why I feel there's so much tragedy in the human condition, but that we can only change that tragedy by ultimately carrying in our hearts. And I was so honored when you said that you felt I could act as a role model, because I really do feel very strongly now, at my age, this great desire to say we can be different. Men want to be different.
Well, and I think, Lee, you know, I think a lot of men don't know how to be different. You know, they've just grown up with this idea, you know, the sort of the testosterone man, you know, and anything else is weak. You know, I mean, maybe not here in California. You know, things are different here. But, you know, go to the Midwest or something, where it's, you know, to be a man, you have to be this macho guy. You know, you can't be an artist. You can't be a writer. You can't be a deep thinker like you. You know, I mean, I know I'm talking in stereotypes, but you know what I mean. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of men just dying to sort of be their authentic self, but society doesn't let them. Our culture doesn't let them, and they don't see enough role models. They don't meet enough men like you to know that there is something different. And I guess I just wish there was a way for men to grow up, you know, and grow to this next evolution of what they can be.
Yes, I do too. I think that this is inevitable. I just painted I paint a lot with 20-somethings, these like Flying Lotus and different really remarkable young musicians. And I was down at the Low End Theory painting live last night, and I was surrounded by really these young men that I can tell are really just, I would have to say, already a very different download, so to speak, than my contemporaries who are in their 50s. You know, that already there's, and I think that what's happened is that this sort of old macho model, which is really hollow at this point, it really isn't the Old West. It isn't the unconquerable land. It's not, the same values aren't there. So it becomes much more of a caricature of the manly man, you know. And I think that when portraits of male become hollow, men see through it just in the same way that women see through hollow portraits of woman. At least some of them do. I don't say they all do, but I feel that again, it is a critical mass story in a way that part of my great desire as a mentor and as an elder to a lot of younger men is to offer them a role model, an example that you can really and truly understand that the first principle is love and honor and respect. And that you know, and I have two daughters, and I also grew up in a home where there was great reverence of woman. It wasn't a type of condescension. So when
right.
I see that, I do feel it almost a type of primitivism, and a type of throwback to where, as a matter of fact, my third book, Adam Reborn and Eve Restored, I realized came out of, I had heard a guy saying, "Well, you know, come from my rib, ha ha ha." But I realized in a moment, being a guy, I said, oh, that's his trump card. He actually believes that. He actually believes that somehow being a male creates a type of superiority. And I went, that's systemically got to change. And I found it very interesting that a while later when this image of Eve on my pillar emerged, my light pillar in the studio, she started to reveal the story of Adam reborn and Eve restored. And in that... Adam, universal Adam, became lost in the vastness of his own creations, and Sophia, the great mother, feeling his anguish under the crushing burden of time's complexities, begins to cry, and from her tears, the immaculate Eve arises into his world to remind him of home, to remind him of paradise, and that she is the heart of the garden. She is splendor. And what's very interesting in the story is that because of this originating fear, that finally he ends up not being able to see her any longer, and he begins to follow the ways of death. And I do feel that what is happening in us is that really woman and man must both reclaim their mythic and heroic version, that maybe the great sacrifice of this consciousness, the great sacrifice of lover and beloved, of Adam and Eve, was to say, if we forget who we are, if we turn our backs on one another, will our love be great enough to survive our distance and forgetting? And I really believe that the answer is a resounding yes, we will remember. But by the time and how we remember, it will be, we will remember because we will have earned true relationship. We will finally give up our childish sense of entitlement that there are chosen people and that there are people that are joining the right club to belong to the right God, and realize that everything that is holy. And that,
you give me such hope, Lee.
Well,
seriously.
And see, that's what the arts, creation, because if you think of the arts, it's the language of creation. And what I love about my work is that I say, it doesn't tell you at any point you must believe this, you must follow this. It simply says, if you consider this, if it nourishes you, remember that you are this as well. And maybe, just maybe, you have convinced yourself, not just in this one form, but across a very long and very difficult journey, that you are inherently unworthy, or you are not the source of your own awakening. And everything in my work is saying, just as the solstice ending of the Mayan calendar is that the solstice or solstice is when the sun stands still, and what it's telling us is that finally we stand erect, finally we stand and hold not following the change of days, you know, the sense of tomorrow I'll be better, but we stand in the experience of ourselves and understand that the turning of days is like the turning of seasons. It's an alchemy that conditions the art form of who and what we are, but we are the art form. Then we stand in our center and we allow others to stand in their center, and we begin to amplify each other rather than diminish one another. And why I say this is what all creative and loving people know is we know we are far more interesting when we act with ensemble, when we listen and when we care, than when we work at the expense of another person. And I really think this other mind that has worked at the expense of others is that fundamental mind that has always said might makes right. There are winners, losers. It's dog eat dog.
I know it would just sap your creativity, but we could use more politicians that think the way you think, Lee. I'd rather have you leading the country than, you know, some of these crazy people that, you know, believe might makes right and all the other, you know, right wing stuff.
You know, I actually feel, Karen, that what's going to happen is that what we're going to find, because if we look at this as a natural, that the monolithic belief that a small group can control everything, which, you know, to a certain degree you'd say, well, okay, I understand the historical element of that, all the fine and well, but that's going to continue, I think, is an illusion, because what we will find is that politics and religion are actually vestiges of the male dominant archetype, because it's all about separating us from them. We're right, they're wrong, righteousness instead of compassion, superiority instead of love. And I think that the whole, because I really get the key from the mother, from the feminine. She says, you must essentially dissolve the illusion that there's something to fight out there, and take from that chaos that is out there and grow the garden that you must grow intimately, because you change the world by changing the story of the world you believe you live.
And that's what you're doing there at Olander. You are living, you are walking your talk, you are living that, because throughout the week, every week, week in and week out, you have these wonderful presentations there. Why don't you talk a little bit about that before we run out of time? We probably have about 10 minutes.
Okay, well, my wife, Carla, and I, who we've been together for 35 years, and just absolute love of my eternity, and we've been holding at our home Olandar discussion groups for over 33 years. But in the last couple of years, we started showing documentaries and having documentary filmmakers here. You've presented your books here. We've had musicians here, speakers, and because one of the keys that I felt again and again, a lot of what I'm doing is a kind of thought experiment of like, well, what if we try it different? And I started to think that Renaissance or rebirth will come from a shared enthusiasm, not a new style or a new form or the art world going, oh, we've discovered the long lost genius, but actually that we gather together and we tell the story that nourishes us. I took this from actually the Transcendentalists, a sense of if the story isn't in that world, then create the conditions to gather and tell the story that nourishes where you live. And so I did that because I was working on the show Dallas when I moved here, which was 1980, and I realized I couldn't change that conversation, but I could certainly hold the conversation that I needed to hold. And so in a way, I was able to double track, and that's why I'm really excited about, again, talking about role modeling or creating a footprint, because when people come here, they come to see my artwork or the hieroglyph, but it's also in tandem then with, let's say, you giving a presentation of your ideas on the goddess, or we'll have a musician here. We had a remarkable pianist last week, and tonight we're showing the really profound and beautiful movie, Children of War, that about Uganda, but just a remarkably healing documentary by Brian Singel, but he's here tonight, and he's going to talk afterwards, and then we're going to Skype Uganda and the woman that he worked with, and we're going to talk with her. And so I feel like this is using, again, this domestic footprint of if you
You know, and don't worry about numbers. I really feel like worry only about understand, because I used my my mom when she had cancer. The oncologist said cancer was a bit like the old Ditto machine, that when the cells reproduced, every time they reproduced, they got a little fuzzier until finally they were completely fuzzy and couldn't remember who and what they were. And I thought, God, that's an example of the human condition, as if all of our cells have gotten fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started with Olindar, this sense of, well, then let me use my acre, my home, my domestic footprint, as a way of putting down a welcome mat to those who care about these things. Because I think the world teaches you to try and convince people who don't care, and then you become very depressed because you're wondering, nobody cares. But to me, it's been telling me, no, Lee, find the people who do care.
Right.
The story
right.
that helps them find healing and that allows them to trust their energy and strength and story. And that's what will happen exponentially. And then
then you all feed each other, and it, instead of feeling depleted and hopeless, you feel empowered, I think.
I do too. And think about the intimate metaphor of home. You know, or your heart, or your part. You know, it really is that. Where do you live? What do you love? What are the stories you want to share with generation? What makes you the human being? You smile and say, "Yes, that feels right." Do you know? It's for us to say, and this is what I do when I give the tour. Now I end it and I say, you know, I've reached that delicious age where I can say I like this version of being human better, and that's good enough for me. I don't have to convince anybody. I just need to hold on to it. And I feel like that's the coming strength. And I think that's actually the strength of the deep feminine, because she says you can grow any change you want to bring. And to woman, I say, remember, you are heroic. You are the source and origin of all creation. You are matter, mater, mother, the weave of worlds. All enter and are woven through you. So stand erect as an ancient tree in that power, and you will feel yourself not simply a woman, but woman. And in woman there is might. And when she holds that might, man then looks to her as the center around which the rest of the world unfolds.
Rather than the subordinate, less than gender.
Yes, because that's why I feel like a lot of it is, you know, there's a lot of, there are stages, almost like healing and grief. There are stages to a lot of this. You know, that there has to be anger, there has to be resentment, there has to be. But finally, then there is, because I get, when I work with the feminine, is what I get is this wave of unbelievable forgiveness.
Mm.
Just that.
Sure feels a lot better than angst and hate and upset and, you know, all of those negative emotions. Well, Lee, let me just ask you this one last question. You've said this over and over again. You've said, she tells me, I hear from her. Can you language how you hear her speak to you?
You know, I say this in the same way that I learned as an actor, that no one can tell you how to play Hamlet. You basically, how can you get me an expert to play the Prince of Denmark? Or where do I pray to? What do I, you know, you realize you're really on your own. You really have to say, well, does this feel right? Does it feel? And so you really start to trust a mentoring voice, a type of, well, try this, try that. And so for me over the years, I think the whole, in a sense, the martial arts of my life has been to get out of the way of my own energy. And being an actor, I realize that I'm not losing my sanity to allow the conversation of different energies or wavelengths to actually mediate through me. I mean, in the same way that I found myself when I played a deranged killer, I it was like I could move into a different energetic truth, like a radio, and then return to myself. And that's really what it does feel like. It feels as if the she, as she emerges, she tells me a type of inward story that has me going, oh my God. And I have to liken that sometimes. I'm a 29-degree Gemini, born on the summer solstice myself, so maybe it's that capacity to hold both, as I say, as an actor, to be both completely crazy and completely sane simultaneously, and to know the difference between both.
It's inspiration. It's ideas that you get. It comes in the form of ideas and inspiration.
Yes, it's like a whisper in the air. Like, consider this. And the other voice is very Socratic. There's always like, will. It's never saying you must believe this. It's never dictatorial. It's always, and what I love about the voice of the deep feminine, with the different feminine archetypes, because I do. When Lilith appeared in the hieroglyph on the back of a painting, another painting of the blossom, I heard her. I thought it was Eve, and I couldn't figure it out. And finally, I heard her say, "It's Lilith," and I went, "Oh, that makes so much sense." And it actually did mythically, because I couldn't figure out what, but it was quite literally the energy itself. But we're so used to thinking in terms of form rather than energy. And if you think of painting as atoms rather than molecules, you begin to understand that why the ancients used paint was they said, we're going to create a worthy residence for these qualities of energies to cohabit and commune with us. And I feel, because of the way this has emerged through me, that it's much more of an ancient energetic language that literally communes through me. And because it's mythic, I realize that my job is to not say to others, oh, and this is through me and I'm the rarefied one and you're not. It says, no, Lee, anyone who enters this sacred space is reminded as a human that they too are these things. What you are doing is teaching them once again to trust these stories.
You're helping them remember
energy. Yeah, and that's really what we're trying to do, is just create permission. It's okay, and it will not drive you insane. As a matter of fact,
and you don't belong in a straitjacket. Hello. Oh, I think he disconnected himself. Well, let's see. Maybe he will call back. We only have probably about 5 minutes left. But what I would like to tell you, listeners, I'm sure you are enjoying this conversation with Lee. Please go to his website. His writing, his art. It is beautiful, deep, rich, potent, hopeful, insightful. It's just incredible. I think you would feel good just looking at his work. And you can find it at his website at www.leemcclosky.com. That's LEIGHMCCLOSKEY. It doesn't look like he's going to call back in, but I think you probably got the gist of his talk. But he has a wonderful tarot book, and I've read some of his work. I've seen Olindar. If any of you who listen are in the Southern California area and would like to find out more about the events that Lee and his wife Carla have at his Sophia Temple, the Hieroglyph of the Human Soul, please just get in touch with me and I will get you on the mailing list. So it's unfortunate we had that abrupt cutoff, but we want to thank Lee for his wonderful inspiration tonight and for his wise advice. And I'd like to remind you that that on March 29th I will have Barbara McGraw as my guest here on the show. We're going to be talking about the subject taking religious pluralism seriously. And then coming in April we're going to have Barbara Walker on the show. We're going to be talking about the morality of the Bible, and Barbara Marks Hubbard will be discussing her new book, Emergence. Lydia Rule is going to be remembering Asphodel Long. We will have a tribute to her. So as we run out of time here tonight, I want to thank you, listeners, as always, for listening, and please have a good week. Remember that Goddess is within you and outside of you. She always surrounds you. So good night. Have a good week, and may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings.